for 4 years and 7 months, in other words, from the very beginning until the end. But in very few years after that, he always told about the disillusionment he had as to the outcome. That is, it was not a finished job in his estimation. He always maintained that there would be a revival of the slavocracy in the South because of the trend that took place after the Reconstruction days, as he put it. But he said that at that time they should not only have eliminated slavery, but they should have also at the same time eliminated the whole capitalist system. Now that was his opinion. As I say again, I don't think that he ever got French. Yes, he was completely French. And he said that as long as the capitalist system existed, he said there's going to be poverty among the people, he said, because of the greed of them. And because of the methods that they were using at that time to reestablish slavocracy on a different basis, not chattel slavery, but by having the economic condition of the people such that they would be able to enslave them. There was one other thing that he said that I think was very important, and that was, hold it a minute here, I want to get it. When he was talking to us kids, he would always say this way. He says the biggest war up till that time, of course the Civil War was considered the biggest, but he said the biggest war has never yet been fought. He says the biggest war is going to be between the rich and the poor. That's the way he put it. It so happened he was born in this country. He was born in New Haven, Connecticut. But then the people, his father being a shipbuilder, migrated or went to many different countries. That is, he went back to France, worked at the shipbuilding business. He was what they called a hewer. And then back to Canada. And at one time, I remember him telling that they went to South America someplace. This was while my father was still, you may say, one of the children that was still in the home. His experience on the seas, as he put in 14 years on the salt water, and he put in about 11 years on the Great Lakes, holding many different positions, mates, and at one time went into the business itself. He and the partner of his bought a boat, which was wrecked in a storm at Marblehead, Ohio. The name of the boat was the Mist of the May. And as I said, the last recollection that I have of his work on the salt water, because of the experience that he'd had in traveling among people of all nationalities and languages, he became an interpreter. He spoke very fluently 7 different languages without ever going to school or college to learn them, until he became this interpreter on a boat that, I don't know exactly if it was entirely passenger boat or whatever it was. Her father was also a veteran of the Civil War who died in Texas, as we remember, always from homesickness for his family. He was a drafted soldier, but never being away from the family, why, it was too much for him. In the same hometown in Rocky Ridge, Ohio, there's a man by the name of Brooks. who was also a veteran and was in prison with my father. And they had planned an escape together. They didn't live both in the same town at that time. And they had noticed, my father noticed, that there was a little ravine that went down through the prison. This was the only place that the prisoners could get water. And the water was so filthy that the only way, my father said, that they could get water at all that they could use was by digging a hole a ways back away from the ravine so that the water could sort of filtrate through the ground or the sand into this hole, and then out of that they attempted to purify to some extent that the water that they got in there. But when they got rains, heavy rains, there was the ravine became a regular torrent, and in the end of the prison where it went through and went out, my dad noticed that there was quite a stream went through there. And apparently there was a possibility of it, if a rain would come that it would be heavy enough, the possibility of a washout taking place. The prison itself was built with piling driven into the ground, and he had watched this place for days, and he'd talked with this Brooks about the possibility of going through, because as he figured at that time, why, if they stayed there, they would die anyhow because of the conditions that they had, the disease, the typhoid, the everything that they were getting from the water and the food and things like that. There was actually maggots in the water. And this rain came, and it was a torrent. And my father says to Brooks, he says, "Let's go." And they both went to the bank. My father dove into the stream, went through with the current, but Brooks failed to follow. But shortly after that, the war was over and he was released. And for he stayed in the stream for more than 5 miles, as he figured it, at that time, before he ever left the bank, or went onto the bank, because they used bloodhounds for tracing them down. But he made his escape, went out into the darkness. He knew that the place was inhabited to a great degree by the Negro slaves yet. He was living there, and he thought that he just thought, or practically knew, that if he went to one of these people's homes or their cabins, that he would get help. He went there and told them who he was, and immediately they took him into the house. And luckily, these people had been helping people before, and they had a regular method of work.
They were Negroes?
They were Negro people, former slaves, or possibly at that time yet slaves. I don't know exactly the day that they were. But nevertheless, he was put under the floor of the house. They had a hole dug there. And then they had something thrown over it. And these people, they would put in there. And then when night would come, they would take a mule in a two-wheel cart, and they would put them in there, and they would take them to the next place under straw, while they on the top would sit on the top and drive. And for several days, this was the method that was used from one place to the other, till finally he got back to where he was, got to the Union lines again. Being that he was only paid once a year, why, they naturally, everything was done on credit. But when it come to the funeral for the baby, the rest was all credit, with the exceptions of when it come to the burial rites, which at that time my people were Catholic. And of course, when they went to the priest about the arrangements, why, he demanded that he get his money. Father told him he didn't have the money at that time, but his credit was good, always was, wherever he was. But the priest just refused to consider this and demanded that he be given the money. But they worked out some kind of a compromise, and they thought, well, they would have the regular funeral. But when they brought when the funeral people came and they brought the baby there, instead of taking the baby into the church proper, the priest only allowed them to bring the baby into the anteroom, never going near the casket himself, but instead going to the front of the church and said a few words, then closed it, and that's all there was as far as the funeral was concerned, which of course made my father very, very angry. But seeing that my mother also was Catholic, why, they tried to just forget about it and go along. But my father was owing the priest, and it was only a matter of days or a few weeks at the most until the priest came to where my father was working in this lime kiln. I'll just give you so many days to have it, or we'll take some action. My father said, well, that isn't sufficient days. I can't pay you before the regular settlement comes. But it was only a few days when he came back and demanded the money that time or else. And of course, father asked him, well, what the or else would be. And he had a bottle, a vial, as my father said, a large vial in his pocket. He took it out of his pocket and he says, you know what this is? Father says, I don't. He says, this is holy water. And he says, unless you pay me today, I'm going to burn you up with this holy water. And he started to open the bottle and attempted to start to, like he was going to throw it onto him. My father, being a fellow with a temper, opened the door of the fireplace, which is a large door. They used to fire these lime kilns with logs, practically as big as a man, those logs were. But he opened the door and he says, I won't burn you with holy water, but you, son of a, I will burn you with natural fire, the only fire that really burns. And it was in the process of throwing him into the fire when one of the workmen there, by the name of James McMahon, who I also have heard recite the same thing when I was a kid, telling about the experience, grabbed my father's arm as he was making a swing to throw him into the fireplace.
He was really good at
He was really going to throw him in. And, well, of course, then he dropped down, and there was about five or six steps going down out of this fireplace, fire room. Father took him to the door and kicked him off the steps, and it happened that he landed into a big mud puddle down below. Well, that was the last that of the priest. So, like in many cases, I know this year I'm speaking from my own observation, because there is another experience that I had, not exactly like it, but bared some similarity. The priests usually have quite beautiful housekeepers. And this one also had a very prominent young lady from near this hometown who was taking care of the house, the housekeeper. They have their pick pretty good. Uh-huh. And then it was just a few weeks after that until the priest disappeared. He went around, collected all the money that he could from everybody where he could get any money. He disappeared. I don't know what became of him, but as time went on, the housekeeper had a baby. This girl had a baby. Now, these are the facts of that case. As far as labor was concerned, of any place in the United States, we had a central body there, the Central Federation, they called it, in which the independent unions, the AFL, all of them were combined, the railroad unions, We're all in this central federation that we had in Carpenter. And when the miners, one of the big things that we had there was usually assistance to the miners. There was very few other strikes that took place. We had one strike at Pittsburgh Big Glass Company there that only lasted 3 days. That was the time that I went down along with a number of others. I was in Pennsylvania at that time. But the Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company thought they had reached a place where they were going to be able to start an open shop glass factory. So a group of us got together. We first took it up in the convention in Cleveland, Ohio. And the officialdom of it at that time says, well, just don't go near them. They can't run a factory if we don't go near them. But there isn't anything that they can't do unless you let them. If you let them do it, they can do it in time. They will take and find probably a couple of glass blowers, for instance, who for a price will go in and become instructors. And the result is about the first thing you have got, you've got an open shop in a field that they've never had, because in all the history of the United States, the only organization which Bill Green said himself was the ideal organization was the glassworkers. The only 100% organization in the United States up until this day. And the railroad workers and the building trades were all in a federation, a mutual federation. And when the miners were struggling, which was often in those days, because two-thirds of the mines was open shop or more. In fact, I got to say right here, at that time, John L. Lewis was assisting the mine operators, being a mine operator himself in those days, and brought about many successes down there. I just only want to give you an example of one. This was very close home in what they call Gokey's Hollow in Clarksburg, West Virginia. There was only a spur of the B&O Railroad that run up into this hollow, into the mines. And up there were just the mines and the miners' shacks with no conveniences whatever. One well for probably probably 100 or maybe 150 families, with no sewerage, no nothing, just the board shacks that in many cases you could see the stars shining through at night. Been in many of them, knew most of the people who lived in. And it is hemmed around completely by a mountain. Just formed sort of a horseshoe up in here where the miners lived. And the miners were on strike, and they attempted the eviction. And of course the mobilization of labor took place. A big mass meeting was called in there that night, but there was only the one inlet to the place, or outlet. And that was the narrow road that followed right along the spur of the railroad, right at the foot of this mountain. And of course, just as the mass meeting is getting started, so happened that I was speaking to the meeting at that time. To the mass meeting, I seen a number of headlights of automobiles coming up this one-way road. I sensed an attack was going to be made. And of course, not knowing all the arrangements that had been made by the defense committee, which was very necessary. You had to have a defense committee, otherwise you would have nothing. One of the members of the defense committee told me to continue speaking, pay no attention, everything is taken care of. Well, I had confidence enough to take his word for it, continued to speaking about how we're going to have to fight to maintain a roof over the head of these families with all of the children. And at that time I began to see headlights of automobiles going down over the side of the, down over the bankman, across across the railroad track and into the creek. And after finding out who they were the mine guards, the deputy sheriffs, the state police, and including John L. Lewis's goons, who was one of the leaders of this. And by name, one of the men's name was Alderman, who I afterwards met here in Minneapolis at the CIO hall. Well, that was an incident laid out in turn for them. They probably, maybe some of them knew that an attack was going to be made. In fact, I wasn't in on our organizing of anything. The only thing my responsibility was to speak to the mass meeting, which I'd agreed to do. I don't know anything about or who led it in 1921, or maybe it was more than switching. I just can't remember, but it was a railroad strike that first took place. And even after all over the rest of the country, Clarksburg, West Virginia, the switchmen still held out against the sellout that took place there, but eventually had to give up. But in Clarksburg, the railroad was still tied up for many days after. And that was where the first amalgamation, or you may say the first unity, sprung up. That brought about this wasn't a fight that was not even authorized. In fact, it was condemned
by the
leadership of the AFL at that time. They done everything they could. But still, up until the time I left Clarksburg, West Virginia in 1927, the Central Federation was still functioning.
Yeah.
That I know was paying per capita tax, of course, to the internationals. All unions paid a per capita tax to the Central Federation, but to any of the international, the AFL, I think only the, mainly the shop crafts, or the shop crafts and the building trades. This is just the way I think. There may have been more, but the glass workers, we were completely an independent organization. And just one little experience that we had. While Bill Green said, on different occasions, but especially on the one when he spoke of the ideal organization of the glass workers, and this was in commemoration, or possibly at the funeral, of Joe Neenan, who was the president of the glass workers for many, many years. His son was a secretary, I suppose still is, if there's anything functioning down there. Why, it was at his death, at the time of his death, when he spoke about the ideal organization of the American glass workers, that if all organizations were like that, then we would have a perfect setup. And it was, within itself, was a perfect setup. But even though being an ideal organization, there was always the attempt of trying to get the glass workers to affiliate to the American Federation of Labor. Representatives came to numerous meetings. They traveled all over the country. But as the glass workers seen it, this would only hamstring them instead of helping. While we were always willing to help all other organizations, we couldn't see where we could come under the jurisdictions of the AFL and be benefited by it. But instead, there was a danger of being craft unionized instead of industry. When the first glass factories were started in New Jersey and in Brownsville, Pennsylvania.
That was an awfully skilled thing.
There was no glass
there.
Workers, that's right, there
Very
was
skilled.
No glass workers in the United States. That is, it was active or working at the trade because there was no use. The glass factories was mainly in France, Belgium, some in Russia. There was some Russian glass workers that came in. But mainly they were French and Belgian. And again, I'll say there was also some German. But when they came here organized. There was one thing when they, companies, and in fact the original glass factory, the first one that started,
was also started by people who came over here to France, from France, to fulfill or the market over here with it and not have to do all the shipping.
Mm-hmm. And they brought the
whoever had a guaranteed wage up
oh,
until recent years. Yes.
Mm-hmm. An annual wage, you mean?
Not an annual wage. The glass factories, when I first went into them, worked only 7 months out of the year. They worked seven and were off 5 months because of the heat. Now, they had no cooling systems at that time. And of course, it's a very hot job. In fact, most people used to say that you have to burn your brains out before you'll be a glass worker. If you had any brains, you wouldn't be. Well, maybe it holds true, but nevertheless.
Does it affect your health eventually?
Very hazardous work in which the insurance companies, first statistics, has had it, the life of a glass worker is 10 years, a glass blower. Doesn't say he's going to die in 10 years, but that's all that he should work at it because of the jeopardy to his health. I worked 14, I don't know, I don't think it ever hurt me at all. But,
what is it?
This is what it is.
Oh, it is.
It's dust and a combination of many things. Of course, bad whiskey has quite a bit to do with it, too.
The glass blower?
Talk about a lot of different crafts that I've been around about them being drinkers. I've never seen anything that equals a glass worker. He was a very reckless type of fella, very good fella, but cared very little for money. I'm not speaking of the majority. I don't know what percentage it would be. Mm-hmm. But as I say, they were very reckless with their money. They worked, they wanted to have a good time. And many of them thought maybe they were going to be short lives, so they wanted to get everything out of life that they could.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them many times work all winter and getting back again to the only one who had a guarantee. You had a guarantee of $60 a week. That was for 40-hour week work. You're paid by the box for making glass.
Oh.
With a varied scale, I mean, for all kinds of different sizes that they're able to cut out of the glass. The different quality that they're able to get out of the glass, this all counts in the scale of working out your pay. There's some boxes of glass that I've made many of them in my life that I got up to $1.18, I believe $1.28 for large glass, something like 40 by 60
for one
in A glass.
One piece.
For one box of glass, which means 50 square feet. A box of glass is 50 square feet. Scoop glass. It's cut into 8 by 10. It would be full of seedy stuff and blisters and things like that. Not very good quality, but used in barns and chicken coops and things of that kind. And they had markets for these. And of course, on that kind of glass, nobody could make a guarantee of blowing. But the company had to pay you. 60, if they run it and wanted you to make that. And the glass was of that quality, that so poor that you couldn't get above, they had to still pay you your $60 a week.
They didn't think of
this is a sort of an interesting incident because they all happened to be my very good friends, and of course I never drank so much myself. But there was a group of them going down on Lake Erie to camp. They have a special place that they go to, and they have their tents.
Yeah,
and some of them do. Some of them have their wife working at something else. But anyhow, they load up the wagons. They were going out there. And I'll say for every pound of bread that they had in there, that they at least had at least a gallon of whiskey and a case of beer or a keg of beer.
Uh-huh.
Oh, they were terrible. But I say they were very good people. At least they were union people. Experience as a full-time organizer didn't take place until the Depression days. I had organized, within organizations, but to go out into the field and organize, I was always working. I'd had several offers of going. The only organizing that I did was getting back to the time the Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company was attempting to start an open shop. But a group of rank and filers decided that we are going to go down there and go to work. We're not going to allow any place to run an open shop. And we did. We went down and we started the very first day that the factory started, without a union. And in fact, we stood suspended from the glass workers organization, because at the same convention where they says just let them go, they can't run without us, they also put through a penalty whereby anyone who would go to work for them, they thought they were going to keep anybody from working for them, anybody who would go to work for them would be suspended, and they would be fined $300 before they could get back into the organization. But nevertheless, we had to take the chance. We just feared that they're going to do it. Well, the result was, we went to work the first day, and 7 days exactly from the day that they started, we closed it down until they signed the contract. And then we were taken back into the good graces of the union. We demanded that Joe Neenan come to Clarksburg, West Virginia. We had a big mass meeting. We were not the only plant there. In fact, I think the window glass blowers, I believe there were either 6 or 7 plants there. And in the main square in Clarksburg, West Virginia, I think they called it Waldo Square, the biggest mass meeting that ever took place there, where Joe Neenan had to get up and compliment all of those foresighted ones who saw the danger and went down and done such a marvelous job. Your relative, it was family trade. Your father had to go to work with your father, you got your apprenticeship, or your uncle. And they finally liberalized it to where you could take in your, well, I said cousin. Your uncle, your nephew, your cousin. And learn the trade, which wasn't good. In a way, it had its effect. It kept it 100% union. I mean, it helped to keep it 100% union. Mm-hmm. But it had the effect that it didn't set too well with a lot of other good people. Years making glass in one method,
one way,
which were discovered according to history by the Arabs with a fire built, as I understand it, against the side of a sort of a mountain, someplace where there was a proper kind of sand or something like that, and the fire melted, or got hot enough to where it had melted some of this sand.
Melted sand.
And the result was it run down, and when they examined it, they found out it was transparent. Mm-hmm. That it had converted it, mm-hmm, from the sand form into a glass form. In other words, they could see through it. And from that experiment, it went on to where they began to then put in methods of melting this, which they used to number of different methods. When I first went in, you had what you call a pot. It's a sort of an individual furnace, large enough to hold a day's supply of work. You went in, you worked it out during the day, not all of it, of course, because you always have to have glass to make glass. You don't take it all out. Oh. Sand by itself doesn't make too good a glass unless you have what you call a cullet with it. A certain proportion of sand, of limestone, of the other ingredients, charcoal and things like that. Charcoal is mainly used to keep it from getting too solid in the melting process. Then at night, when you quit and blown out, then you recharge that pot, or in other words, you refill it with the batch, if they call it. That's this mixture of stuff. And then it's melted overnight, not until you come the next day. From that step, it went into the tank form. Instead of individual pots, they built larger tanks. And then all of the workers worked out of this tank. Now, a short description of the tank is something like they call it. That's where the...
Well, that's where it comes from.
Gathering boy gathered the glass on a pipe out of this molten glass. And Then after he worked it into the proper form, why then it was handed over to the blower, and he blowed it into a cylinder of glass. Of course, the tanks is still old. I mean, they've been improved a lot. They're larger, greater capacities, and now I've seen tanks I suppose it would be 50 foot wide. You spoke of the transformation. This was the most rapid, I suppose, transformation industrially that I know that took place anywhere. Was from the time that they started to change the methods. Instead of blowing by hand, they put in a blowing machine. And that was worked on different methods. Again, they went back to a pot where they used a big ladle and they took glass out of the big tank and put it into the pot. And then they had machinery that was put up over this. And the pipe went down into it, got a hold of your glass, and then it was pulled by machinery as you went up like this, and then it was a matter of regulating your air and your speed to keep your glass as properly discovered, making it by machinery, blowing it by machinery, until they had completely abolished that, and they found out that they didn't have to blow it at all in the cylinders. But instead they have machinery that comes right down, gets a hold of the glass, starts it up into a machine that has rollers on there. And these rollers take this sheet of glass and just continually keeps pulling this right up between these rollers, see? Mm-hmm. And it just continues to pull that sheet of glass right up, and all there is to it is to cut the glass off into pieces, take it into the cutting room and cut it up.
The real craft.
That you could watch anybody blow it. It didn't make any difference. They say you've watched a guy for 100 years and you go up there and you can't blow one.
No.
It was a matter that your instructor, your master worked.
Mm-hmm.
He even had to take hold of your hands. When you had this pipe and you're swinging this ball of glass and cylinder, to know how thick that is, it's a matter of feel. You can feel it pulling on your hand. And then you can also learn to sight down through glass. A glass blower sights down through glass, and he can tell you how thick that is by looking through it edgeways. Well, there's a number of things that you've got to learn to make this stuff, you see.
Well, the timing.
And heat.
Heat.
And, there's so many different things.
Must be a delicate thing.
And when to blow, how hard to blow. It's all a matter of you've got to be coordinated with the glass, you see? Otherwise you couldn't make it. I've seen guys, I mean, when you try it sometimes. Just imagine to make a blowing with your mouth through a pipe, to make a cylinder of glass 5 feet long and 16 inches in diameter. And if you don't make that nearly perfect straight all the way down, the flattener can't flatten it out. If you've got that there, we used to call New York ladies, in and out with a lot of curves, you know? Why, you couldn't flatten that. When the flattener would go to flatten it out, it would be what you call ruffles. Wherever you had it a little too big, that'll all ruffle up. And the result is he couldn't get any size of a sheet out of it, a sheet of glass. You have a variation that isn't exactly 16. You may have it 16 and a half. Maybe you have 17, or you may even have 15 and a half. But usually, you've seen in the glass factory when they take these out, and you will see dozens of these rollers of glass laid on what they call the splitting block around there. And if you took a rule and went over there, I bet you wouldn't find a variation of more than a half inch. You see, you blow your glass according to the orders that you have. They want to cut, the company gives you an order, they want to cut certain sizes out of
things. Yeah,
they did. There was lots of them. They'd do anything before they would go back in and try to make glass any other way.
Yeah.
That guy was a homesick guy for their trade, even as bad as it was, that you ever see. You know. Well, it's like in most cases. I don't know if there's so much of fear of their job, or if it was actually sort of a homesickness for the trade.
Yeah.
Yes, in the glass factories. I see, I was there from 1914, 1927, 1913 to 1927, all 13. And there was a new generation came along. There was only one bad thing about it, among some of them. They began to organizing groups of 400 classes. I don't think we should put this on the record. This took place in the glass industry. But there were not the strikes like in all other industries, without exception. There was never a picket line around a glass factory that I know of, except that one that we had right there, that I said about when we were in the same hotel. You have a messenger, a runner, as you call it, that when you finally get down, and usually the conventions consist of the one main topic, the wage scale. Nobody was fighting over offices in there because very few of them wanted an office. And so it come to the wage scale proposition. And of course on that there was conservatives, and then there was the progressives, and there was the radicals. And I mean the people who actually wanted to get something worthwhile. Even if it wasn't all wages, better conditions, cooling systems, grievance committees, and so on and so forth. We didn't usually have to have a grievance committee in the factories. If you knew there was a place open someplace where there was short of blow, you went in there and you went to work. You didn't ask the boss nothing. They couldn't fire anybody. I mean, you was on your own. The thing was, if you wasn't an average worker, or at least fairly good, the thing that would put you out of business was you couldn't get a crew to work with you. You see, you had a whole crew. Mm-hmm. This whole crew is paid on the basis of how much the blower can make, the quality of his glass and everything. The gathering boy gets 85%, as much as the blower gets. Mm-hmm. And then on down the line to your different ones in the crew, they're all figured on the basis of how much that crew puts out, how good it is.
Oh.
So you know, they had to be good enough, at least, that they could have a crew to work with. But to get a job, you just went and took them. It was a matter that your demand was taken over to the hotel where the employer was meeting. It was handed to them. They chewed the rag over it, and on a few occasions, I remember, they says, "We'll never pay it." Glass worker says, "Oh yes, you will pay it." And we didn't have to argue with them at all. We just went home. And when they got ready to open the factory, they just sent out word that we're going to start to work on such and such a day. And that's all there was to it. There was no negotiations, no compromise, no conciliation, no nothing.
Nobody came.
Nobody came. Nobody went to the factory. And of course, we, a lot of us, glad when we got word that they're going to start up. But nevertheless, we never worried about it. And they had all the employees.
The employees had a banquet?
The company gave it. The company gave a banquet. And the big celebration was that the factory has completely paid for itself. That's what the celebration was, and they wanted to thank all of us workers for doing that. So regardless of what the wages was, and they had a lot of highly paid men, glass flatmans and cutters and blowers and all these were highly paid men. Nevertheless, in 5 years, they had completely paid off the investment that they made there. Well, that there shows you regardless. I mean, they still made plenty of money. Now, let's start in the 30s. Huh?
I bet you're not going to go back.
The
Black 20.
Unemployed Council was started in the year of 1930, following the big mass demonstration in Union Square in New York, demanding unemployment insurance or jobs, which rapidly spread throughout the country, including Minneapolis, that began to organize on the ward and precinct basis and down into the block committees. To my recollection, the first organized hall in which they were able to hold large meetings was on Minnehaha Avenue, just south of Cedar Avenue, which rapidly expanded throughout the Sixth Ward to the extent that there was in the 13 precincts. I know that there was at least 9 that had large block committees. And then going on a larger scale to where it began to develop into a citywide organization, originated around the Block 20 strike of workers who up till that time was unorganized, and in fact they were tearing down these buildings, and in most cases Rose Brothers, who had the contract of clearing this out, was giving the workers the broken wood for their pay, and they had to find ways and means of getting it home, not even being delivered by the company. But with the help of the building trades, mainly led by the Lathers Union, which has stood out in Minneapolis in the past as one of the most advanced and militant organizations, went to the workers on Block 20 and organized them around the question of demanding wages instead of broken wood for their pay, which rapidly began to bring results. Within a few days after this, and then with the help of the then existing unemployed councils in the city that collaborated with and together the building trades and the unemployed council called a strike. This was one of the very first beginnings of the struggles of the workers in Minneapolis. But along with that, there was one other struggle that was also taking place, and that was on the Ford Dam here, in which also the Lathers Union was helping the workers there that up until that time were unorganized to demand a halfway decent wage scale. Around the Ford Dam, a big struggle took place. The workers were attacked by the police. Many arrests were made. Now, the same thing happened on Bridge Square. Immediately when the workers struck against Rose Brothers, demanding wages, the whole city police was mobilized to go down there to terrorize and in some cases attempt to drive the workers back onto the job. But nevertheless, the workers became aroused. They joined the building trades unions, especially the building laborers at that time, and this began to force some of the leaders of the building trade unions to give assistance to this struggle. Now, that was a part of the beginning of the unemployed movement, which grew till the unemployed council became a citywide organization involving thousands upon thousands of workers. I, after being out of a job, up until 1932, I was working in the Caterpillar tractor, a machinist. But when the strike on Block 20 took place, knowing that even the job where I was working didn't have any security, it was not going to last long because industries were shutting down all over the city, and it wouldn't be long until they hit us. There is one little sideline that I would like to present here. Why was the Caterpillar tractor able to work at practically full capacity up until 1932? It was mainly because that they had a contract with the Soviet Union to manufacture for them $15 million worth of road machinery. While all of their other factories were closed down over the country, this one was operating until they completed this order. One other thing that was very interesting here was when they attempted to make the wage cut, the so-called national policy of cutting wages all over the country. Some of us in the Caterpillar tractor had got together and demanded that we would, or stated that we would not accept any type of a wage cut because we knew they had a contract for this and they were getting all of their money and there was no necessity of any type of a wage cut. In one of the conferences that we had, our committee, representing the workers in there, while not at that time yet being an affiliated organization of any time, nevertheless, the company had to recognize us because of the strength that this group had within the factory there. The superintendent of the factory at that time stated that this is national policy, we've got to make the cut, and the thing is that the company hasn't got the money, and then they will have to go along with the national policy. So we asked the superintendent. He claimed the reason why they didn't have the money was because they had millions of dollars outstanding to various states and counties throughout the entire country who couldn't pay the obligations for the machinery that they had bought from the Caterpillar tractor. At that point, I asked him, not thinking at this time just what his name was, but anyhow, I asked him this question. The contract that we have here and are working on, while you have named Iowa, Dakota, and even as far away as the state of Rhode Island, that if they would pay the Caterpillar tractor, that would help to alleviate the financial situation. Now, we are not working on machinery that's being produced for any one of these states. So I ask you this question. The $15 worth, yes. Before we deliver one piece of machinery, the gold is already deposited in a bank in the state and city of New York.
Gold?
Actual gold bricks. That's what he said. Actual gold bricks are deposited there. Well, I says, then, why should we have to take a wage cut just because the state of Iowa and Dakota, and as you say, as far away as the state of Rhode Island, owes the Caterpillar tractor so much money? Now, that was a thing that I wanted to put in here. But nevertheless, while I was working there, and the struggle of Block 20 was going on, we discussed it, and in many occasions and on many days, there were some of us who left the factory, the plant, and went down to Block 20 to assist in whatever way we could in the helping of the workers to win this struggle on Block 20, which did terminate after quite a period of time in the paying of wages and setting up a wage scale. This was practically the first wage scale that the building trades was able to establish in Minneapolis during the Depression days. Even those who were in union and in the building trades and others were going out scabbing on themselves whatever they could get wherever they could get work, even working at their trade below the what was supposed to be an established union scale. Now, the unemployed movement grew to where it became, under the unemployed councils at that time, one of the most influential and strongest organizations in the city of Minneapolis, and likewise in many places throughout the country, mainly organized around the issue of relief checks, in many places cash relief so workers could buy where they could get the best and most for their money. This required numbers of demonstrations, numbers of mobilizations, mass meetings, marches to the courthouse, to the welfare board. One of the earliest one among them was one that was called for to assemble on Bridge Square, right near the Block 20 project. I think everyone who had anything to do with this was actually surprised to see the turnout. There was leaflets issued throughout the city, no one knowing what the response would be, although knowing the conditions of the people. But actually the thousands of people that turned out there in support of the demands that was presented by the Unemployed Council was really surprising. The march was formed to go to march up Hennepin Avenue to 5th Street, from 5th Street to the courthouse, knowing that at that time and that hour the welfare board would be meeting. As the demonstration or march proceeded up Hennepin Avenue, the workers seeing in one of the big stores there all of the good things, and maybe some of them wasn't even looking for such good things, but just anything that they could get to eat. But nevertheless, they saw the store with its shelves full of food, its windows full of food and meat and things like this. Apparently, the temptation became too great for people with empty stomachs. And the result was there was a surge to the store. Immediately they entered in there, and while I was not a personal eyewitness to this, nevertheless I seen the results shortly afterwards. Within a very few minutes, some people even said seconds, but I think this would have maybe been impossible, this vast store that reached from the street to the alley was completely empty, to the extent that there was not even a can of beans left on the shelves. And when the demonstration or march dispersed, many people went with their arms and their pockets full of food to their homes, probably with the first meat that they or their family had ate in many, many days. This was some of the situation. Prior to this time, there was no relief, no relief orders, no cash relief. When people became so desperate that they went down to apply for something to eat from the help, for the help from the city, they had a room down there. This room had some food in there, food that was given, donated probably by some stores or from other places that maybe they couldn't sell themselves, and in many cases was uneatable. I seen with my own eyes this one situation where a family with a sick mother and the son had to go to get something to eat. The family was starving. So I went with them. This was while I was still working in the Caterpillar tractor. When I got down there, they had a basket. They packed it with cabbage that was rotten, with potatoes that were rotten, with a few cans of beans that the label was all brown on, and I believe it was one or two cans of condensed milk. That was for a family of three, the mother being sick at the time. Now there was many, many situations that Minneapolis stood out in. One of them was, as the organization grew, policies were adopted. Among those policies, one was, and people were being evicted by the hundreds and threatened by the thousands. One of the parts of their program was, there shall be no more evictions in the city of Minneapolis. And this was one, as I said, outstanding. Because when this policy was adopted and the organization had the strength, evictions were stopped and the city was forced to give rent allowances plus the grocery orders. I know in one case, this happened in the Sixth Ward, at one time the unemployed council was stopping three evictions simultaneously. And in each case, first the number one case, the sheriffs, deputies, and those who were supposed to do the job came early in the morning to evict this family. And I want to say that this family had lived in this house for the same landlord for 20 years. And in conference with the landlord, he had admitted that this family, while the man had worked, had never missed 1 month's payment. And this landlord happened to be Fulcherman, who runs the big department store, who owned and did own numbers of houses there. But in this one case, the sheriff thought this was a good job as far as they were concerned. The furniture had been loaded into a van to be taken where even they couldn't say where it would be put. Someplace in storage with a family, a father who was sick at that time, and a mother and four children. And when the question was asked, where is the family going, they said that that is their business. But the unemployed council seemed different. The unemployed council was going to live up to the policy that they had adopted and proceeded immediately to unloading the truck, putting it back into the house, and putting and turning on the gas and the electricity for the people therein. This was, as I said, in conjunction with two others that was going on within a radius of four blocks, all at the same time. Of course, you could go on with the numbers and numbers, but I only want to quote one more. And that was in concerning a woman, a Mrs. Martin, whose husband had died years before, leaving her with two small children, both girls. She had been a day worker, a person who cleaned house, done laundry, done anything that she could to support and bring up these children and attempt to give them an education, in which she succeeded with one, to where she had brought her through music school and to where she was even a music teacher. But even after learning this, she had no demand for her services because there were thousands of music teachers, yes, of all professions, that was also unemployed at that time and therefore was unable to help. But she had accepted a job as a housemaid someplace out in the neighborhood of the Lake of the Isles. When Mrs. Martin wanted to get relief, or she had been getting some relief up to this period, but when this girl had accepted this job out there, which she stated afterwards required at least 14 to 16 hours a day, taking care of the whole house, children, washing, ironing, cooking, in fact, to where she could hardly stand on her feet at night. And I think I'm quite correct when I say that for this work she was given $3 a week, that she said this. But when the welfare board found out that this daughter was working, Mrs. Martin went to get her relief The welfare board says there is no more relief for you. Your daughter is working. Therefore, you will not get relief. You will not have your rent paid. This went on for some time. They were not connected with an organization. But one of the members of the unemployed council who lived in the rear of the same building, for a day or 2 days or more, she had heard crying in this front apartment. Her and this lady hadn't been on the best of terms to the extent that they were too neighborly, but nevertheless, this woman who lived in the back just couldn't stand it anymore. She knew there was something wrong and therefore went in to investigate. And there she found Mrs. Martin lying across a bed in a very weakened condition. And she wanted to know what the trouble was. And finally, Mrs. Martin told her the situation. The relief department had not only told her they would not give her more relief, but she would have to be sent to a home someplace. That is the only way that she would be able to live or get anything to eat or a place to sleep. This here, Mrs. Martin, as she said, was the worst blow ever struck against her in her entire life. After working all these years, doing everything she could to bring these children up, help them, to give them an education, and then to tell her that her home would be busted up, she would be sent to a home, was just more than she could take. Then our member of the unemployed council, one of the great members, we must say, notified the unemployed council about the situation. At that time, I was the city organizer. Immediately, I went over to investigate. And there I found, as she had represented, the facts existed. A little hesitant, Mrs. Martin, in cooperating with us, because she had never heard of such an organization that could get relief, that could prevent her from being evicted. But nevertheless, in desperation, she says, I will cooperate. Well, we proceeded to the courthouse with a committee of five. There we got the same answer that she'd told, that they had told Mrs. Martin, that you will now go to a home, your youngest daughter will be put out into another home, and the older daughter already has a job, so that will solve your problem. But we says this solves no problem, but instead she must be given her relief, she must have her rent paid until she is able to procure work, which she wants to have, if she can get it. But we were flatly turned down. But we also had another policy, and that policy was, if five can't get it, maybe 50 can. We had the organization and we knew they would respond when they knew the facts. So we immediately, without even publicizing, it didn't even have to put out a leaflet, but we followed up. A few of our block committee captains. Remember that in each one of these block committees there was a captain. This captain in turn, if it was a large block committee, and this is a lesson in organization, I think. This captain had sub-captains. If it was large, say that we had a block committee of 100, and this was not a rare occasion, no one had responsibility for more than 10. And if the block committee captain, we asked him for so many people that we need a larger committee, we called him up, went to his house, and it was only a matter of minutes, in many cases, until he had the required number. Now back to the case. We told the welfare board at that time that if five can't get it, we will bring 50. If 50 can't get it, we will bring 500. If 500 can't get it, we will bring 5,000. Maybe sometimes they had doubt of our ability to mobilize this number in short periods of time. But nevertheless, during this one day, this one day period, after first the five had gone, we brought 50 or more. The same answer was given. We told them we'll be back. It was not long until we were back. There was probably over 200 or 250. This did not yet get the results. But then we put out a general call for a mass mobilization to the courthouse that day, to the welfare board, and the result was, before 4 o'clock or before closing time, there was 4,000 people, even admitted by the papers here in the city, there was over 4,000 people had mobilized around the courthouse and at the welfare board around this one demand that Mrs. Martin be given her relief and her rent paid. Well, of course, at that time it got too much, and they, as usual, always think, well, all we have to do is bring the police and they will take care, charge of it. This demonstration had been completely orderly. But when the committee of five couldn't get results, we thought probably it would require a committee of 50 right into the superintendent's office. Superintendent of Relief at that time was a man by the name of Gerlog. We went into the, with about 50, I believe, into the room. The policeman came down, marching in, and of course, as always, figuring, well, if we can arrest all of these leaders or something, we can't read their mind, we don't know what they thought, but anyhow, they were going to bust up this demonstration. But instead, the workers were well organized and they knew what to do. It was just a single door as they came through, and each one, as they came through one at a time, was disarmed by the committee. Their weapons, blackjacks and guns, was laid on the table in the center of the room, and the policemen were told, now stand up there against the wall and nobody will get hurt. We don't want anybody hurt. But we must have relief. And of course there was no trouble. They did. They stood there. Then of course the argument with Gerlog for relief. And this reached a very climatic condition. This was in the office part, and there was hundreds of people sitting out waiting to get their relief. Even at 4 o'clock at night, they hadn't been able yet to get all of the people who were already waiting for their relief that day. But these people out there, seeing the commotion, seeing the police, there was windows, a number of them, where each person went up according to your number or your alphabetical name or some procedure that I don't know. But each one had a window. And the result was, when the word got out there that something was going on inside, all of the people wanted to see. The result was, instead of one person being at the window, there was actually dozens if they could get that close. It so happened that the petition that petitioned off the room where they were sitting in and where the office part was a rather flimsy situation. And with so many people leaning against the petition caved in, fell inward. Some of the people who were sitting around got a little bump here and there, maybe on the head, but it was not the people in the demonstration, as the paper said, that tore down the petition. It was the people outside who wanted to see what was going on. But of course that caused a lot of confusion. Everybody in there, including the clerks and everybody, got very excited and began to run. And of course the unemployed council told them that there would be no harm done to anyone, that just to be calm. But it reached a point where Mr. Gerlog, who was still obstinate, refusing to give relief, but we says, we must have it. Mr. Gerlog, if you can't write out a relief check for this woman, the unemployed council will. And we took him out of his chair, sat down in it, took his relief order book, and started to write out an order for relief and for rent. And at that time, Mr. Gerlog says, oh no, I will give it. Well, this was quite a long story, but this was an instant that showed you the militancy and the determination of the workers led by the unemployed council. And it began to grow into where it was a national organization, the necessity of coordinating the work on a national scale, which required the calling of a national convention.
When was that?
The year. I'm a little off maybe on some of the years. It seems to me that it was in 1932 that the first unemployed council convention took place. Right. At the unemployed council convention, we had whatever the time was. I remember when the delegates come back telling about what, naturally, a report to the organization, what had been decided. And there's where the question was taken up on a real national scale for unemployment insurance.
Oh yeah,
at the unemployed council. Uh-huh. Was the first one who brought it out on a national scale.
That's for that.
And then of course, seeing the necessity of forming a national organization, Minneapolis, Minnesota received their call. A number of delegates, that I'm not sure just what it was sent from here, bringing back the report, what the policies, a constitution was drawn up, and what the demands would be to alleviate the misery of the unemployed. First among those demands was a demand for unemployment insurance. It's quite a thing now to think about everybody who is for unemployment insurance compared with those who were for it at that time. Today, the trade unions, and of course we don't want to take anything away from them, is now not only fighting for unemployment insurance itself, which has been won, but they are fighting to better unemployment insurance, Social Security, and everything. But very seldom do they tell the people where this actually originated. It was on a national scale at this National Unemployed Convention, demanding unemployment insurance or work. Also, putting into their program the calling of a national conference in Washington, D.C., for support to the unemployment insurance measure, which was taken up by Congressman Lundeen and introduced into the United States Congress. I was a delegate to Washington to this National Unemployment Insurance Congress. There was 1,500 delegates from ministers, many rank-and-file trade unionists, some of the minor leaders, officers in the national unions of those days that was there. And at that time, the conference visited numbers of congressmen. In fact, they were supposed to visit congressmen and senators from every state. And they did. But when the conference adjourned, they also put into the program that unless unemployment insurance or work for wages was given to the people, then they would call for a mass march to Washington if the Congress failed to heed. Well, the mass march didn't take place, but just shortly after the broad conference took place in Washington, at Roosevelt, President Roosevelt's suggestion. A CWA program was worked out in which $1.25 billion was appropriated by the federal government. This was a step, but along with this, it was of short life. The CWA program was only a drop in the bucket in meeting the needs of the hungry people of this country, only supplied work for a very small percentage. Maybe there was somebody under the illusion at that time that a short measured program like that may solve some of the problems. But the CWA money was soon used up, matter of only months. And then new programs had to be put in effect. Along came the WPA, the ERWA, or whatever they called it. But anyhow, one program after the other had to be put through, but in each one it took a large amount of pressure from the unemployed people. But along with this, the trade union movement began to become more active in supporting these demands. The rank and file, in which in many cases the overwhelming majority of the trade unions were also unemployed people who were both trade unionists and members in the unemployed councils. So you can see here that it took great struggles to bring about anything such as unemployment insurance or Social Security. It was not a thing that was handed down by the good sentiments of any of them. It was a matter of struggle on the part of the workers. Now, when these public works projects took place, many of the unemployed people were put to work. It required a sort of a different type of organization. An organization that could both fight for relief and an organization that could fight for jobs and for decent conditions and wages on these jobs. Therefore, it was decided to form a new organization, to be an all-inclusive organization, to take in both public workers on the WPA projects and to take into the unemployed and to take care of their needs also. This organization was decided to be the Workers' Alliance, which grew to be the largest organization in the United States at that time, which had many, many struggles. Instances, those who were in control of CWA, WPA, and all of the other, sometimes they call them alphabetical soups, but nevertheless, they were not liberals or progressives who were put in charge in the main. But those who always looked forward to try to keep the standards of the workers at the very lowest level. And so, cases like in Minnesota here, they attempted to make skilled workers work at laborers' wages, which required many struggles and in some cases terminated in actual strikes on the job. And I only want to cite one at this time, but there is several other in the state. One of them was at Pine City, Minnesota, where the government under the WPA project was putting in a dam. And there they had the cement finishers and the skilled workers. They would not pay more than just the very minimum wage that was allowed to employed councils.
That's what I'm trying to get.
Well, as long as we have mentioned about farmers and the struggle of the farmers and the ability of the farmers to struggle, I also want to cite this one instance.
probably we should cite more. First, the milk strike that took place right here around the Twin Cities. The livestock strike, where the had refused, the farmers were refusing to take their stock to market because many times when they shipped their stock to market or took it down to market, they didn't even get enough for it to pay for the gasoline or the transportation of it. So I want to deal on this farmer's strike in the milk, the farmer's strike on the livestock, and also the farmer's strike that took place in Elk River, demanding that their county be taken into the drought-stricken county, or at least a county that demanded emergency relief.
Is that Stearns? What county?
Yeah, that Stearns? Was Stearns. I believe that's Stearns, isn't it? Well, but anyhow, the milk strike, many people thought that the farmers were incapable of putting on a strike here that would prevent the delivery of milk at the ridiculously low price, as I say, that didn't even pay for the handling. But they did. But in this case, there was an interesting sidelight to it, which the unemployed council brought about. A milk strike naturally would bring a lot of suffering to people, to babies, to children, to everyone. Therefore, the unemployed council immediately, when this strike, before this strike was to take place, tried to and did work out a policy whereby we were able to get unity with the farmers, whereby we was able to see that milk was brought into the city, but not to the milk companies, but would be brought into central places and there would be rationed out to the families on the basis of their need for the milk, this way completely eliminating the milk companies here. Well, this year, even we had a conference with the leaders of the farmers, the unemployed council, and the city administration. Whether or not they wanted to agree or not, nevertheless, they had to agree that the farmer's strike was justified, and that the people within the city would have to be provided with milk. A real policy and program was worked out. The strike took place, and not one city milk truck or city dairy got any milk during the duration of that strike. Every road in the vicinity of Minneapolis here in particular was blocked. And I'll tell you, those farmers were determined. I don't remember the length of time, but I know it went on for at least over a week or possibly 10 days, and the milk companies had to raise the price of milk that they would pay to the farmers. And in this way, it did show an example here of how the farmers will and do fight for the thing that's right. Now going to the one at of the stock strike. Heard about the fights, the penny sales where they had foreclosed on farmers and had brought their auctioneers. Some cases the auctioneers were literally chased away from these. In some places the farmers worked out a policy of bidding a penny when the auctioneer put things up for sale. And they had had both in Aiken County. That was mainly on their machinery, their stock, and things like that. But then it comes to the question of taxes on their homes, their homesteads, their farms. They were unable to pay them, and the result was in Aiken County there, they had decided to evict 1,400 families. I think I'm quite correct that that was the state. 1,400 eviction notices had been put out. But they come to evict, and did evict some, I believe,
But it raised the militancy of the farmers because they realized they had no place else to go. That was their home. That's where they had. It was a strike for the farmers, as I said before, were refusing to take or sell their livestock to the packing houses here and stockyards because they could not even make the expense of taking them in most cases. Of course, like in all cases, it's too bad, but it is that way. There is always somebody who is willing to try to break this. And we're sorry, we find it among the workers. When workers strike, we find somebody, maybe because they don't know better, or maybe because it's just their principle, they will go in and scab. But we found a few situations, families, and there's where they were going to stay. So prior to this meeting, and it also became statewide publicity, that there they had to resort to different methods to stay in their homes, and that was they had to guard their homes. Well, it happened in one case prior to this meeting, and that's where then they were going to prosecute those who were responsible for taking this action. Farmers, the same among the farmers, but very little. And in this one case that I want to make brief was the incident that happened around Howard Lake. Here was a situation where the farmers 100% and in that vicinity refused to bring them in. One of the trunk highways leads through there, and there was some cattle truck went through. The farmers were quite sure that they were not farmers who were delivering this livestock. But anyhow, they were going to stop it. So, one time, or rather, one truck came blasting down through the town of Howard Lake with its horn going. The farmers attempted to stop it. They couldn't. It hit a woman. Luckily that she wasn't killed, broke her leg. But nevertheless, the farmers didn't weaken. They were more determined than ever. And the result was the masses of the farmers attending the mass meetings and the picket lines increased. So, they also called on the unemployed council. Knowing that the unemployed council had put up struggles and fights and had won, in other words, they sent a committee down and asked us if we would come out to help them in the organizational work. And we did. I am among them who went out. And we went to Howard Lake. So we had mass meeting there, congratulated the farmers on their stand and their fight for the thing that was right and things that would help them to live. But while a mass meeting was going on, another truck came, and it blasted right through. The picket line got out of the way, but somehow down the road, this I don't know about. In fact, I seen it afterwards, I read the paper, the account of it. But nevertheless, the fire or the truck run into a plank that had the spikes sticking upward, punctured the tires, threw the truck, the driver, into the ditch, and when they went to see who it was, they found a man who was afterwards was checked up, and they found that he had been a criminal, I'm quite sure, sent in here from the state of Ohio, who had been a professional scab or strike breaker, with three guns in the cab of his truck. One of them was a high-powered automatic rifle. But nevertheless, after this incident took place, then they had to step in the authorities to see what they could bring about. The result of that was,
an agreement by the packing house workers. It so happened that we had here a farmer labor governor at that time, Governor Floyd B. Olson. And through Governor Floyd B. Olson, the farmers' organizations, whatever they had at that time, they had two, in fact, in the field. The names of them was the Farmers' Alliance. The other one was the Farm Holiday, which afterwards became consolidated into one big organization. And through these conferences, it was worked out and agreed that the packing house workers shall have to pay a minimum, whatever it was, the price, but nevertheless it was an increase that the farmers could and did accept, and this brought to a conclusion the fight on that one. At Howard Lake were combined. There were separate organizations.
Was John Bush?
The workers, or the Farmers Alliance was, I don't know who the president was anymore. Well, now only one more incident on the farm, to show that they also fight. During the drought...
Wait a minute, I think I have to turn this over.